This is Ask an Astronomer with Tim O'Brien and Nick Rattenbury. This is part of the Jodcast, and for the full show, please visit us at www.jodcast.net.
Our first question comes from Che Knight. Is the nearby electric railway noticeable to the telescope? And I imagine he's talking about all the telescopes at Jodrell Bank, but presumably mainly the big Lovell telescope. Is the nearby electric railway noticeable to the telescope, or do you just happen not to look that close to the horizon, or are we able to tune out the effect?
Yeah, so I mean, for those of us who haven't been to Jodrell, there is right next to the big Lovell telescope, there is a railway line that runs past. It's probably only about 100 metres or so away from the telescope. It's pretty close.
You can certainly hear trains going past.
Yeah. I mean, it's in a little cutting, so it is quite low down, as the listener was implying there. But yeah, you're right. He's right that it was a real worry when it was first proposed that this be electrified. You know, sort of nearly 50 years ago or so. Of course, the only reason Jodrell Bank is where it is because of the interference in Manchester, and that was from electric trams. And the problem is basically sparking. So when you get an electric spark, that generates a huge slew of radio waves right the way across the spectrum.
This was, funnily enough, this was the original way that radio waves were discovered in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was Hertz, who we named the frequency scale after, in 1888, I believe. I can be corrected, I'm sure. But yeah, it was an electric spark in the lab that showed sort of some sort of action at a distance or something, you know, when a meter moved across the other side of the lab when he set off a spark. So yeah, it would have been a real worry when it was proposed that section of line be electrified. And the problem was, because these things called pantographs, they're the sort of spring-loaded thing that sits on the top of an electrified train, and it presses up against the overhead cable, because the electric power in this case is coming through overhead cables. What happens is, as the train goes along, these things would sort of occasionally spring off as it sort of bumped along. They would lose contact with the overhead cable, and then you get this arc, you get this spark across. And in fact, you know, if you can remember back many years, you'd see these sparks sort of lighting up the night sky from railway lines, and that would have been producing huge amounts of radio. So in fact, the solution was, there was a lot of conversation between the astronomers at Jodrell and the railway company, and they actually redesigned the system on that section of track to cope with it. And I believe what they did was to reduce the height of the cables. So bring the cables down closer to the carriage, which increases the pressure on this spring-loaded pantograph thing.
Right, so it's less likely for them than to separate.
Reduces the chance that they disconnect, basically. And then I think, and which sorted the problem initially, and then I believe that what's happened since is that the whole way in which that's done has been redesigned. So in fact, it's a much more less likely thing generally. So even, you know, nationwide, you don't see that sort of arcing anymore, really. Mm. Unlike you used to do. So in fact, it's a problem that's largely gone away. And the other interesting thing about it, just to add something to that, is that in fact the reason Jodrell Bank exists at all is because of Sir Bernard Lovell, of course. And the reason he's interested in science, for those of you who listened to the Jodcast last month and listened to the interview I did with him a few months ago, he was inspired to become a scientist by visiting a public lecture at Bristol University on the electric spark. So it was basically going into this lecture and sort of seeing these flashes of light and smelling the spark as well, all that sort of, you know, all that visceral stuff, you know, that inspired him to get into science in the first place.
And these sparks, these massive arcs, were a window into a whole new way of looking at the universe,
which he opened up.
Next question is from Stephen Wheatley about comets. Whenever you look at a comet, it's a fuzzball outgassing and spitting out bits in nearly all directions. Perhaps this happens when comets get too close to the sun, but how close is too close? So that's the first question, how close is too close? And the next question is, how far out does a comet have to be to accrete anything? Is there much material that far out to accrete?
Right, okay, well, I think there's perhaps we should start by just reminding ourselves what comets are. And I think it starts to help answer the question a little bit, actually. I mean, they're basically sort of, the classic phrase is a dirty snowball.
Dirty snowball, yeah.
Yeah, so they're basically made up of ices and bits of dust and a bit of rocky material as well, sort of mixed up. And actually, they were probably formed very early on in the formation of the solar system. So they formed during that whole phase when the dust was sort of coagulating, sort of accreting together. So Stephen uses this phrase accretion, so this idea of things sort of sticking to each other, basically, this sort of things being gravitationally pulled onto something else is often what we talk about when we talk about accretion. So there's this whole process of bits being stuck together to make bigger bits. And that whole theory has had a lot of impetus recently because of the discovery of planets going around other stars, of course, because we've had to sort of revise our opinions of how that occurs now that we've got all these other examples of planetary systems to compare the predictions of the theories to. But basically, in that story, these things called planetesimals form, these very fairly small sort of rocky icy objects whose composition might vary as a function of their position from the distance from the central star. And it's thought that comets really formed at that stage, that they're sort of basic building blocks of the solar system. Mm. And what we think happened was that many of these things would have been ejected from the inner solar system, from the sort of planetary region of the solar system.
How do they get ejected? They get flung out. How?
Yeah, gravitational interactions, basically. So as the bigger objects formed, as the bigger planets start to form, then basically close encounters with those objects can either result in, you know, you could find that you accrete one of these objects, or in fact, just, you know, as we do with spacecraft and we're sending them out to other parts of the solar system, we use this sort of slingshot effect where you can come close and sort of use the, you know, borrow a bit of energy from that orbit and sort of whiz yourself out to different parts of the solar system. That could happen with the comets, where they basically get ejected out into very large orbits. Now, in fact, we think that that's what populated something called the Oort cloud,
right.
Named after Jan Oort, which is basically thought to be a roughly sort of spherical distribution of many comets, maybe a million comets, something like that, out to very large distances from the Sun. In fact, you know, half the distance of the nearest star, roughly.
So it's sort of... That's a remarkably long way away, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's interesting...
To still be, you know, part of the solar system, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically to the point at which otherwise they'd not be gravitationally bound to the Sun, I suppose, and I suppose that's the sort of distances you get to. It's interesting, I always imagine it's interesting to think of these things, that you think of stars as these point-like things going around the galaxy, but in fact, if each of them has this big spherical cloud of comets that extends, you know...
More like bubbles of...
Yeah, they're sort of like bubbles of stuff, you know, there's not a huge amount of mass in there in total when you add it all up, but you know, there's many of these individual objects. And they're sort of sitting out there, and of course, as you can imagine, as the Sun orbits the Milky Way, it passes by, the stars have got different velocities, different... paths of the motion. They come near to another star that can disturb the orbits of comets in the Oort cloud and cause them to be perturbed so that they basically fall in towards the Sun. And as they come in closer to the Sun, then you get this effect that Stephen refers to, which is this outgassing effect where you warm up this icy object and it starts to build up this so-called coma, this cloud of gaseous material around the comet, and then the solar wind itself sort of drives away this coma to form the long tail. Now that's sort of typically, you know, these things become visible typically when the comet's within, you know, a few AU or so of the Sun. But you do see, you know, you do see these sort of fuzzy halos, you know, at larger distances than that. So basically it's a sort of continuous process, really, that as it comes close to the Sun you can start to form these coma. Now, in terms of whether you get any accretion, well, given that these comets basically formed at the origin, you know, a long time ago, early on in the solar system, you're not really forming them anymore. I mean, these things are sort of there. Largely what's happening is they're dying, I think. So if you get a comet that gets brought into the inner region of the solar system and maybe it goes into some sort of relatively short period orbit, say like Halley's Comet's orbit 76 years, it's really only going to take maybe a few hundred or so, it depends on the comet, orbits for it to sort of lose all its material and basically die.
Yeah, so it's losing more of its material than it will ever accrete going out again.
That's right, yeah. So you know, they're not going to go back, it's not going back out again and re-accreting stuff and regenerating itself for its next pass through. It's basically just gradually losing more and more stuff. I guess if something got way, you know, if it went way back out into the Oort cloud, then maybe there's still some stuff lying around out there that you might get a bit of accretion going on. But those are typically not the comets that would, you know, that people would be familiar with. I mean, the other region of these sorts of objects is called the Kuiper Belt, which is basically a sort of more disk-like distribution. So where the Oort cloud is a spherical thing, out to very large distances, like half the way to the nearest star, sort of inside that, and sort of out beyond the orbit of Neptune lies this sort of disk-like population of comets and similar icy, rocky, icy objects like the new dwarf planets that have recently been discovered. Those things are in the Kuiper Belt. They probably got formed in situ then at the origin of the solar system, and they've never gone anywhere. That's why they're in a disk.
Mm.
They've not been ejected anywhere like the Oort clouds.
Their own reason was stable orbits then.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't get that same thing going on with the outgassing process and so on for the standard comets.
And how close can a comet get to the Sun before it gets deleted?
Well, the interesting thing is that I used to occasionally give talks about the Sun, and I'd often preface showing one particular movie as being the most exciting astronomical movie I'd ever seen. And
what was that?
And it was very sad. it was from Soho, which is one of these. Have you seen there's a coronagraph on Soho, which basically is where you put this sort of sometimes a finger of metal or something, some physical object that blocks the light from the bright Sun, so that you don't overexpose your image on the camera. And you can look at stuff around the Sun, near the Sun, and it's used to look at the corona of the Sun, the outer atmosphere of the Sun. But there's a great, there's several examples of this, but there's a great movie which shows a coronal mass ejection. So, you know, when basically one of these magnetic flare loops breaks open and you get this loads of stuff out rushing from the Sun in what looks like a huge explosion, which is a great movie on this Soho movie. But what happens just before it is two comets sort of arrive stage right, and you can see their tails, you know, the bright nucleus, and you can see the tails sort of arcing away from the Sun, and they sort of come in from the right and they orbit around the Sun a bit, and then they disappear behind the blocking disc of the coronagraph and never come out again. So basically, you know, the Sun is basically hoovering up comets quite regularly, in fact. So yeah, so that's what happens to quite a lot of comets that come near the Sun, is they disappear straight into it.
Very good. Okay. Next question is from Mark Godfrey, and he writes, I understand that general relativity says that gravity happens because a large mass distorts space-time. But how does that make things move?
Right, okay. There's a lot of information buried in that question, but maybe we can think about it in terms of that. There's a classic model, isn't there, that that people might have seen, where you've got you take something like a rubber sheet, and you put a heavy ball or something in the middle of it, and that, because of the gravity of the Earth, of course, in this model, that heavy ball is sort of pulled downwards, and the sheet sags. So you end up with this sort of funnel-like shape. And then what we've got to do is sort of think, how is that an analogy for curved space-time? Mm. Well, what it would be is that the heavy ball sort of represents, say, the Sun or something. And that's basically a source of gravity. And then what it does is it distorts space-time around it, curves space-time. That was Einstein's sort of geometrical interpretation of gravity.
The stretched rubber sheet.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the way to think about it is to think about, you know, our interpretation of gravity, the way in which we interact with it, or the way in which we observe it, is to sort of feel it as a force. So if we think about even just, you know, holding a ball or something in your hand and letting go of it, if I was to do that here now, then that ball would drop sort of towards the centre of the Earth because of that force of gravity. The way in which, you know, as physicists we often think about those things, we think about something called a potential, a gravitational potential. The simple way of thinking about that word is probably to think about it as a sort of potential for movement.
Mm.
So if I was holding this ball in my hand, there's some potential for it to move, and if I allow it to, if I let go of it, because actually, obviously, at the beginning I'm holding it up, I'm resisting that potential. If I let go of it, then the potential causes it to fall, that movement becomes real. And what's happening is the ball's moving in what's called a gradient of potential. For it to actually start moving, there's got to be a gradient in the potential. And the way to think about it in terms of this sheet model is to think about, you know, then say a tabletop. Put the ball on the tabletop, it wouldn't move.
Mm.
Okay, if I tip the tabletop, then it rolls to one side. That's like the gradient of the potential. If you think about the tabletop as being the value of this potential, if it was horizontal, it's got the same value everywhere. If we tip it, then you can get to this low potential down to one side and the ball starts to move. So what's happening in this curved space time is you see this sheet as the sort of potential. What the fact that the sheet is tilted at an angle is what gives you the force that acts on the ball. So the gradient of that potential gives you the force. Once you've got a force acting on anything, then the object's going to move.
It's going to accelerate.
It's going to have an acceleration, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've got Newton's second law, for example, F equals MA, force is the product of mass and acceleration. So as soon as you've got a force, you get this acceleration, and in a way the ball goes down the gradient. And in the case of this rubber sheet model of curved space-time, then in that case you happen to have a changing gradient, actually. Because if you think about it, the gradient's less at the edges of the sheet and it's steeper as you get towards the middle.
It looks like an inverted funnel.
Yeah.
Or not even an inverted funnel, it looks like a funnel.
looks like a funnel, that's right. So it's sort of like what the interpretation of that then is, where would the force be biggest? Mm-hmm. It would be near the middle, is where the gradient's steepest. We've observed that's how gravity behaves, that the force is greater nearer the object, because it's this inverse square law, it goes down as the force goes down as the square of the distance away from the object. And in that interpretation of a curved space-time, it's bigger near the object. Mm. So yeah, if you had this thing, if that was the sun, and you sat a ball or a planet or something, and if you were able to just place it in position at some distance from the sun, it would accelerate towards the sun. It would basically be rolling down that gradient down into the middle of that funnel. In fact, of course, the planets aren't doing that. We're not all falling towards the sun, luckily. We're orbiting around it. We're counteracting that by having this initial component of our motion that's side on, that's sideways, and that allows us to go round and round, effectively, roughly in circles, in ellipses, of course, round and around and around this funnel. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay.
Thank you very much.